Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, and it's time for the Constitution Hour. Welcome, one and all, to the Grand Illusion. You know that song is quite true. Don't listen to the newspapers, TV, or the magazines to show you pictures of how your life should be. That's just someone else's fantasy. Well, they want it to be your fantasy. Consumerism is what drives this whole thing, as we well know. I find it interesting, kind of pick up where we left off last week, find it interesting that at a time when we have Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and others moving to dethrone the dollar, we have a revitalized fight, a new Cold War that's being called in some circles. And it shouldn't be that interesting, especially considering some of the players currently behind the scenes, specifically one Zbigniew Brzezinski. You know, if we go back to Afghanistan and look at what was going on in Afghanistan, and quite honestly, we have to ask ourselves, what was it that caused the Soviets to go into Afghanistan to begin with? And remember, we're talking 1979 here, and in 78, Brzezinski, with some of his boys from the CIA, were working very diligently to entice the Soviets into a military move into Afghanistan. And it obviously worked because the Soviets moved into Afghanistan. And it's interesting because the Soviets marched into Afghanistan and it took them merely a few days to reach Kabul and take control, essentially, of Afghanistan. And they spent the next 10 years trying to get the hell out of Afghanistan. And, you know, we're left with these images of our government secretly funding the Afghan Mujahideen, the freedom fighters in Afghanistan. And I don't know about anybody else, but it kind of conjures up the image of all these poor goat herders, these poor guys that live in Afghanistan, being equipped with AK-47s and grenades and grenade launchers and eventually Stinger missiles, and maybe even receiving some training here and there. But by and large, you think of indigenous people there in Afghanistan that were militant Muslims who were absolutely diametrically opposed to the Soviet occupation of their country. But nothing could be further from the truth. In the 1980s, William Casey, the director of the CIA, and Prince Turki bin Faisal of the Saudi Intelligence Agency and the Pakistan's ISI worked together to create a foreign legion of jihadi Muslims, or so-called Arab Afghans, who in fact were never Afghans and not always Arab in Afghanistan. The foreigners were supported by the Services Center, a gentleman by the name of Maktab al-Khidmat, or MAK for short, M-A-K, of the Jordanian Palestinian Abdullah Azzam, and the offices of the Muslim World League and the Muslim Brotherhood in Peshawar, Pakistan. This is from Peter Dale Scott's book, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. He goes on to say that this project did not emanate from the Afghan resistance, but was imposed upon it. According to the Spanish author, Robert Montoya, the idea originated in the elite safari club that had been created by French intelligence chief Alexandre de Marenches, I don't speak French, in 1976, bringing together intelligence chiefs such as General Akhtar Abdur Rahman of ISI in Pakistan and Kamal Adam of Saudi Arabia. So we see that the relationship of the CIA to Arab Afghans, the Mach, and bin Laden has been much debated. One journalist, Jason Burke, denies the frequently made claim that bin Laden was funded by the CIA. The 9/11 Commission further asserted that bin Laden and his comrades had their own sources of support and training, and they received little or no assistance from the United States. Now, you know, it's interesting that the 9/11 Commission, they may have even actually believed that. Another interesting part of this whole story is how the drug trade plays into the whole story. And if you're looking in our chat room, you'll see that I put up, remember the old slogan for the war on drugs, just say no. That was started by Nancy Reagan after her husband's inauguration. And isn't it curious that at about the same time that the covert operations and intelligence agencies of the United States are using drug trafficking, heroin and opium in particular, to fund putting together this foreign legion or mercenary group, if you will, called Al-Qaeda, what we know them as today. But at that time, there was an influx of heroin into the United States, and it was becoming a problem, so much so that the First Lady, who I am quite certain was absolutely oblivious to the source of this influx of heroin, she is putting out a campaign to just say no about drugs. And I put up, Nancy Reagan was asked about her efforts in the campaign and said, quote, "If you can save just one child, it's worth it," end quote. Now, that's kind of interesting because we heard that same phraseology from the current administration regarding gun control. If it saves even one life, it's worth it. Remember that? Kind of curious, you know, how we're trying to turn a phrase that was used by the first lady of one of the most popular presidents that our country's ever had, Ronald Wilson Reagan. And I don't think that Reagan was necessarily privy to what was going on behind the scenes. That's not to give Reagan a pass, because he did make some poor decisions, I think, as far as foreign policy was concerned. Some of that may be because he was ill-informed or misinformed by the inner circle that was around him, being Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, William Casey, a few others. And, of course, the Rockefellers play prominently in this as well, and the Wall Street crowd. I want you to, when you have time, if you're listening in the archives, look up a couple of various operations that our CIA conducted in those years. One is going to be called Operation Cyclone, and the other is Operation Mosquito. Now, there's a good reason why I'm interested in these things again, in part, as I said, because it seems that we are ramping up the rhetoric between the United States and the former Soviet Union, which is evidently now Putin land, or the land of Putin. I don't know. He seems to be the duly appointed king, according to U.S. intelligence reports. One of the things that's disturbed me in the last week was the report of this Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 being shot down at the Ukrainian border. Now, the first thing that popped into my mind was Flight 370, the missing Malaysian airliner flight. How long did we stay in the news with that story? And granted, you know, the loss of life and the fact that an entire 777 aircraft just goes missing was an intriguing story. And with 280 passengers on board, it's just terrible that we have so many people, family members losing loved ones, people just perishing, presumably, and presumably crashed somewhere, but who knows? There were rumors that it was on an airbase in Diego Garcia. And so out comes this report, and I also noted that the same day that report came out, Mr. Beck did a show where he was talking about or explaining the things that the NSA is able to do with the new media, the new information media, meaning your BlackBerry, your iPhone, your iPad, your Twitter account, your Facebook page, and so on. He was explaining how they can create false Twitters and make it look as if they've come from someone's phone or system, how they can actually insert false data into your phone and make it look like you've been talking to a known terrorist, all coming from our intelligence agencies. This capability that they have to manufacture evidence that could convict you in a court of law and put you away for life or even see you face the death penalty with nothing but circumstantial evidence. So it's ironic that on the same day that Glenn Beck airs this program, there is this report of this aircraft being shot down by the rebels. And of course, wouldn't you know, the initial reports were that they tweeted they had shot down a plane, which wouldn't be wholly out of the ordinary, as they've shot down several planes, evidently. That's what we're told. But we have to remember, who's feeding this information to us? Well, it's coming direct from U.S. intelligence sources. Well, now we know that those sources are not credibly believable. You know, it's like the little boy that cried wolf. So I don't believe a damn thing that U.S. intelligence sources tell me. Not that I believe the Afghans or the Ukrainian rebels or the Russians. I don't believe any of them. But I found it interesting nonetheless. And I called it when I heard the report. Are we sure this isn't Flight 370? And I said that about half tongue-in-cheek. Wouldn't you know, about 10 hours later, there's a report that comes out that one of the rebel commanders, I love how this works, it's all secondhand hearsay information. One of the alleged rebel commanders had information that he was told by allegedly an individual that was on the scene, eyewitness, that the bodies that they were finding were not fresh. They didn't have any blood in them. That they had blood serum. All their blood had been drained out. They had blood serum in them. And that they were smelled of decomposition. Well, now this seems to me at that point to be an attempt, or at least setting the stage, to later claim that this is Flight 370 and that the United States government has blown this plane up over the Ukrainian border to make it look as if they've shot down a commercial airline. And, of course, the black boxes were recovered, and they were being sent to Moscow. That was the last we heard. Then today, I read that Obama came out, said, well, what are they trying to hide? And now the United Nations is involved, and we're going to have some alleged independent verification. And there's been stories out of how the human remains and the bodies have been mishandled, left out in the sun and left in a refrigeration car that wasn't refrigerated for some time because it ran out of fuel. So now we have the other side setting the stage to counter the claim that these bodies were not fresh. So I just find it very intriguing and interesting. And we have to pay very close attention and be very vigilant to the stories that are coming out to try and discern who's telling the truth, or is either side telling the truth. You know, it's really tough to say. It's easy to imagine that these rebels, you know, at 33,000 feet, it's really kind of tough to read the advertising on the side of that aircraft. Hey, Cal, glad you could join us. And so, you know, I don't believe that if it was shot down by rebels or Russian supporting fighters, you know, fighters that are siding with Russia inside the Ukraine, if it was shot down by one of those groups, I don't believe it was intentional for them to take down a commercial aircraft. And why would they in the world believe they were shooting at a commercial aircraft? Who in their right mind would run a flight path over the Ukraine anywhere near those areas, knowing that they're in a war, a civil war right now? So it's kind of, the whole situation is kind of crazy, to say the least. But I did find it interesting, the little tidbits coming out in the news. And all of it, interestingly enough, is more or less wild speculation than anything else. You know, these people are saying what they believe, what must be, what might be, what could be, So there's apparently no firsthand accounts, no reporters on the ground, on the scene. And even if there were, judging from past performance from Fox and CNN, would we believe them as well? So I just felt that the opening song, The Grand Illusion, talking about don't believe the radio, the TV, or the magazines, it was appropriate. I think it's as appropriate today as it's ever been. And I know that most of the folks from Patriot families are either heading home from Indiana or just getting home and perhaps recuperating from their travels. So hopefully we'll get some Patriot families folks coming into the chat room this evening. But I do see we have Cal living with us. And, you know, who knows, maybe we'll get some more folks to sign on with us here in a little bit. I don't really go all out and try to do a bunch of promotion for the show if people want to tune in. I've been doing this show long enough, they know where I'm at. If they want to come listen to me ramble, they certainly can. Cal, you kind of missed maybe the first part. I was talking about a current book that I'm reading by Peter Dale Scott, The Road to 9/11. Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, and basically kind of running over our involvement in Afghanistan and how the Mujahideen came to be and the fact that we were recruiting radicals from all over the world and paying and training them and paying them to go fight in Afghanistan. It wasn't like we were just arming an indigenous population to fight the evil Soviet scourge. We actually created, built, crafted a very large army. Well over 100,000 individuals were trained to fight the Soviets. So we did a pretty good job, and we're still paying for that today, I believe. There was a center, the Al-Qaeda Center in New York, Brooklyn, I believe it is, was one of the recruiting centers here in the U.S. We were recruiting extremist Muslims right here in the United States. But, of course, we were smart. We were sending them over there to go fight over there, getting them out of the U.S. Some of these guys were actually trained in Virginia. You know, they had military training on U.S. military bases. So there was some taxpayer funds being used to train these guys. It wasn't all just illicit, you know, drug running money that the CIA was using. And I put that quote up there about Nancy Reagan because this was all occurring at the same time that Ronald Reagan was elected president and Nancy Reagan, First Lady Nancy Reagan, was running the Just Say No campaign in the war on drugs. And I just find it interesting that our own government, the CIA, encourages drug trafficking and increasing heroin or opium production in Afghanistan and in the Pashtun region in Pakistan. And so the influx of heroin into the United States increases by 60%, and here at home we start a war on drugs. So we're going to get both ends of the spectrum here. It's good business back at home because it fills up the prisons and creates plenty of revenue for local police departments. It's insidious what's been done. And, you know, they had this Operation Mosquito, which was a plan in 84 to take the heroin and the jihad into the Soviet Union. And the plan was to get the Soviet soldiers addicted to heroin and cocaine. And this was all run through, you know, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. Everything was done through Pakistan's ISI, which is their service. But it was all coordinated with Saudi Arabia and the CIA, and in many instances, British intelligence, MI6. It's quite fascinating, the irony in what we have created. And many of these guys weren't even Muslim. They just wanted to go kill people, which is even better for us. So I encouraged everyone to look up Operation Cyclone, Operation Mosquito. And I don't want to just bore everyone to death with, you know, excerpts from this book, but I'm here to tell you, it's, to me, absolutely riveting, because it explains more of the backstory that we never got during the time of the Iran-Contra hearings and all that was going on then. And quite honestly, I was a young man at that time and in the military. I was in the U.S. Army in 1983, so I really didn't give a damn about any of this stuff, didn't know half of it was going on, and if I did see anything about Iran-Contra, I thought, you know what, that's Colonel Oliver North. They're doing what needs to be done to help protect America, and I was all for it, all in favor of it. Little did I know that, you know, they were just wholesale murdering people. Some of the death squads that they put together, the Sandinistas and what was going on down in Nicaragua. It's terrible. And these things are done in our image, in our name. And we pay for this to be done. And is it any wonder that many countries and peoples around the globe hate Americans? Again, it's, you know, like Ron Paul said, they don't hate us because we're free. They hate us because we meddle in the affairs of their country and we impact their daily lives, and in many instances in a very, very negative way. And most of these guys, if we go all the way back to the end of World War II, you know, the first five guys that were picked to create or form the CIA, they all had international banking and investment banking ties. You know, it's all been about money. In the end, you know, we have, I remember reading the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. If you take these individual reports and books on face value, just one aspect, it's terrible what's been done. We've known for decades, people know that the CIA do nasty things. And we're supposed to just trust that they're going to do the right thing. Well, clearly, just focusing only on Al-Qaeda or the Mujahideen, whatever the hell you want to call them, if we only focus on that one project, the one operation, let's take stock in what it has cost the United States of America in terms of blood and treasure. And just in Iraq, Afghanistan, and New York City, this has cost us, ladies and gentlemen, over 10,000 Americans, 10,000 lives. Much of it done at the outset by a guy named Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, if you can't tell by his last name, being a Ski, he's Polish, and had a real hatred of the Soviet Union. I get that. I understand it. But we've allowed a few individuals' ideologies to shape our foreign policy and to put the lives of our troops in harm's way and cause the death of tens of thousands of our men and women, not to mention the estimates of well over 1 million Iraqis and God only knows how many, you know, Afghans and whatever other nationalities were over there in Afghanistan fighting us, Pakistanis. Look at the cost in human lives. Then let's look at the obverse, the other side of that coin, and look at the cost in human lives and suffering created by the drug trafficking that is used and created to finance this nonsense. And has it made the world a safer place? I would have to say no. And we're only looking at one operation. One. It's been said that since its inception that the CIA has had 3,000 what they consider major operations and 10,000 or more minor operations. So this is just one and a continuation of one single operation. It's insanity. Is it any wonder that we find ourselves in the position that we're in today? And it's also, is it any wonder that we find ourselves heating back up with the former Soviets, the Russians, when we have the same guy back in a position of influence in the Obama administration, the same Pollock from the Jimmy Carter administration, Zbigniew Brzezinski. The guy is an egomaniac. And he's just got a real issue with Russia. But, you know, even then, even back in the times of Carter and Nixon, the national intelligence estimates and reports said that, you know, the Soviets really weren't much of a threat. They weren't. They weren't trying to expand their empire. In fact, there's only been one expansionist empire on the globe in the last 50 years or so, and it would appear to be the United States, because it certainly looks like we want to control everyone else's governments. And we've instituted that control through the petrodollar, which, if you've listened to my program for any length of time, I've gone into great detail explaining the petrodollar, how it arose, and how it operates. And, you know, the thing about the petrodollar, after World War II, when we were pegged to gold, you think about this, we hear all the stories today still about gold price manipulation. You know, the whole world pegged their currency to the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was pegged to gold. And, gosh, it would be important for the U.S. to control the price of gold, wouldn't it? Well, we couldn't pay our debts in gold anymore to the other countries, or we would have lost all our gold. I suspect we no longer had it at that time. I suspect we had hypothecated it, leased it out, loaned it out, and it no longer belonged to us. So we went off the gold standard. President Nixon violated the Bretton Woods Agreement, and the dollar was pegged to nothing. And people started to get antsy. And then suddenly the dollar was pegged to oil. It's interesting because we've had two Saudi oil embargoes in the United States. One, nobody remembers. 1968. They were pissed because we sided with the Israelites in the Six Days War. Nobody remembers the Saudi oil embargo of 1968. A lot of people remember the Saudi oil embargo of the 1970s. And isn't it interesting? As soon as the price of oil is pegged to the value of the dollar, we have an oil embargo which quadruples the price of oil, meaning it quadruples the value of the dollar, the purchasing power of the dollar. Now, how awesome is that? It was known, it was done intentionally, and it was done to squeeze some of the third world countries, really put pressure on people, and the only option they had was to go buy U.S. treasuries. So it just seems to me fascinating, or at least obvious, where these policies came from and where they're headed. And we sit here and watch this propaganda that passes for news. How do you know, ladies and gentlemen, who to believe? How do you know who to believe? Do you believe one of the 16 intelligence agencies in the United States? Do you believe the talking heads on CNN or the talking heads on Fox News? Or maybe the talking heads on the NewsHour with Bill Lehrer? I mean, seriously, so many of these people have ties to either Israel and Zionist factions, or they have ties to the Rockefellers and the Trilateral Commission or the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, the story that I was relating about the bodies being mishandled, that came from Chatham House. You might have heard of Chatham House, maybe you haven't. Another name for Chatham House is the Royal Institute for International Affairs. You can't make this stuff up. All of the stories that I have seen published that have come out about the downing of this aircraft have been from various intelligence agencies and think tanks. Why is it that we get our news, ladies and gentlemen, from the Royal Institute for International Affairs, from the Heritage Foundation, from these other think tanks? What happened to journalism? What happened to the truth? How do you know who to believe? I'm not sure you can. Even if you're there and see it with your own eyes, you don't know who was behind what, the motivations that were driving whatever the incident is. Very, very interesting indeed. All of the Caspian Basin in the 90s, you remember the 90s, right? Soviet Union's collapsed, communism is dead, and now you have all these freedom fighters who've defeated the great Soviet bear. What do they have to do? They've got nowhere to go, nowhere to play. But there was an interest in the Caspian Basin, which would include many of the stands, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan. I can't keep track of all of those places over there. But suffice it to say, it's in the Caspian Sea Basin. And the interest that they created was for natural gas and oil reserves. And there was a company that was working on building a pipeline, because the Soviet Union and the Baltic states around it, the newly freed Baltic states, well, they're kind of landlocked. There's a Black Sea, or the Baltic Sea there, but it's an inland sea that's completely landlocked. So oil transportation was pretty important from those Baltic states, and the best way to get oil out of a region is by pipeline to a deep water port somewhere like, I don't know, Pakistan, India. So you go across to Afghanistan with a pipeline. And that company, the name of that company was Unocal. And Unocal was trying desperately to build this pipeline, but the daggum thing kept getting blown up by these Afghan warlords. And so we had a little negotiation. These guys called the Taliban. They were going to give us security services for our pipeline in exchange for vast sums of money. And it's interesting because a couple of people that worked for the company Unocal became prominent players later in the game. A lady named Condoleezza Rice, and she worked with another fella. His name was Hamid Karzai. So as you're probably aware, Karzai ends up becoming the elected president of the new Afghanistan after we went in there and kicked the snot out of the Mujahideen freedom fighters that we had trained to fight the Soviets, and we've run the Taliban out of town. And you think about it, when we went into Afghanistan, that had to be like throwing down the gauntlet to these fanatics that we armed and trained and paid to fight the Soviets. Now we come swooping in there after 2001, and they got to be thinking, huh, you want it? You're on. We've slain one giant, now we're going to slay the other one. Again, not trying to give them any pass. I don't admire them at all. But it's just, we created it. We created the situation. It was our Frankenstein monster that we had created, and we're still dealing with it. And that kind of brings up another thing I never understood. When you see these guys on television, they're always wearing black hoods. I didn't know that these international jihadists were so, oh, what's the, camera shy, that they don't want their faces shown. You know, I have a theory on that. I think a lot of times when you see the guys wearing the black hoods, that the reason they're wearing the hoods is because they're probably contractors or CIA or both. You know, how do you spot a guy that works for the CIA? They don't exactly wear a uniform or a badge. So how in the hell would you know? But somebody might know. Somebody might recognize them. So they're going to pull that black ski mask on over there when it's 100 degrees in the shade. And then we've got our border crisis, our very own border crisis. And, of course, they're going to use children. What else would you use? It's absolutely heartbreaking. And I think of the kids, you know, that's the really, in this border thing, they're the ones that get hurt the most. And there is an easy answer. Gosh, excuse me. The easy answer is to remove the incentives for them to come here and enforce our law, secure our border, and enforce the law. We don't have to be zealots and tyrannical overlords when enforcing the law. Just enforce the law, and that can be done in a very humane and kind manner. But hell, look around at our police and the, you know, the plethora of videos that come out seemingly daily and how the police react to individuals. And that's not all the police. Many of them are really good guys. You know, and some of these folks are just fishing for a reaction. Trouble with that is, if they didn't catch any fish, they'd stop fishing. See, if they weren't finding anybody out there to have these negative reactions and act like a power-hungry Napoleon or worse, you know, go nuts and choke a guy to death because he's selling cigarettes individually on the sidewalk without taxing people. So you choke him to death. Is that what the hell we've become in this country? Our public servants act as judge, jury, and executioner? What public service was that officer performing in New York by choking that man to death? That's what I want to know. We got a long ways to go, boys and girls. And I think we're about out of time to get there. I don't think it's going to get better anytime in the near future. I hope that it does, but I don't believe that it's going to. I was going to do an hour and a half tonight, but I think I'm just going to cut it at an hour, maybe just shy of an hour, and go do a little more reflection this evening. So I hope you guys enjoy the show, and we hope to see you back here tomorrow night for the Patriot Family's Hoot and Holler show at 7 p.m. and Wednesday night for Miss Linda from California with Right from the Left Coast. And then on Thursday night right here at 6 p.m., Miss Terry Rowland with Patriot Education. And then also on Thursday nights, Higher Truth Radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time with my good friend, Mr. Michael Brown. So until then, you guys have a great night. I want to thank you for listening to the show. God bless, and we'll see y'all later.